This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. In one of his first executive orders after the inauguration, Donald Trump withdrew the United States from negotiations over the TPP, also known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
The proposed trade agreement was used by both Democrats and Republicans during the campaign as a proxy for the pitfalls of globalization. Since then, foreign policy and trade agreements have taken center stage in the Trump administration, but it remains unclear how the president's rhetoric will translate to action.
Edward Alden is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, who specializes in U.S. economic competitiveness and trade policy. He was in Milwaukee recently to talk about his recent book, Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. And he met with us then to talk about U.S. trade policy. Edward Alden, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
It's great to be here with you. Thank you.
So just to get sort of a history of trade liberalization in the United States, you know, how did we get here?
Well, let me give you the 30-second history. So the 30-second history is you go back to the late 1920s and 1930s, and we tried a very different approach. So the United States, in response to the Great Depression, closed its market to imports with the hope that by protecting ourselves from import competition, we would manufacture more stuff ourselves and we'd all do really well. Well, the result was every other country followed suit. The Great Depression lingered for much longer than it needed to. The world descended into war, et cetera. In the wake of World War II, American leaders and British leaders and others decided that one way to prevent a repeat of that catastrophe was to create a system of global trade rules that would gradually, over time, bring down the taxes that were charged on imports. They're called tariffs. And in the Second World War, on a lot of products, they were 50, 60, 70%. So huge taxes on imports, which made it very difficult to sell a product made in Canada into the United States or made in the United States into Europe. And so basically, American leaders believed that it would be a good thing to bring these charges down over time. And the United States helped organize a series of what were called global trading rounds, in which tariffs were brought down dramatically over the course of the next 40, 50 years. And gradually, the trade negotiations became more and more complicated. They included not just eliminating tariffs, but dealing with government regulations and subsidies for corporations. What would the rules be on those? And a whole series of other things. And then expanded from there into these narrower deals, the NAFTA with Canada and Mexico regional deal. We've done a lot of bilateral trade deals. So over the sort of past half century, we've built this huge global network of trade rules that's now under the biggest challenge that any of us has seen in our lifetimes.
It seems like it's a really complex web of these different deals. But at the center of it, it looks like the United States is one of the major players.
The United States accounts for a quarter of the world's economy. And it has been the leader in terms of setting these trade rules and trying to enforce them around the world. So yeah, the United States, more than any other single country, created the modern global trading system in which we live.
And yet at the same time, the United States, it seems, has disproportionately been affected pretty negatively by this globalization.
Well, this was, you know, obviously a huge debate in the last campaign. And you know, if you go back 20 or 30 years, most Americans thought that they were winners from globalization because it's brought us a lot of good things, you know, cheaper clothing, cheaper television sets, been good for U.S. foreign policy. We built strong alliances in Asia and Europe in part through trade. But it has also hit parts of our economy very hard, particularly the manufacturing sector. And so, you know, you go back to the 60s and 70s, we used to make television sets here. We don't make television sets in the United States anymore. Obviously, a lot of our cars are imported. We import a lot of steel now. There are a whole lot of products that are made abroad, and that has had the effect of putting some manufacturing workers out of jobs. Where it really hit hard was in the 2000s, following China's entry into the World Trade Organization, which is the big umbrella trade organization for global trade rules. And in the 2000s, about a third of all U.S. manufacturing jobs were lost. That wasn't all a trade story. Some of that was technology. Robots are increasingly replacing people in manufacturing. But that hit a lot of places very hard, particularly in the industrial Midwest. So some real losers along with, you know, many winners.
You know, I think like a lot of people, I don't know that much about trade policy, except what gets filtered down through politicians. And as you mentioned, it was a big issue in this last election season during the campaign. What are they getting right about the story, and what are they kind of missing?
I think the thing they are getting right about the story is that as a country, we should have paid a lot more attention to the workers and communities who were affected negatively by trade. And we just didn't. I mean, if you compare it to Europe, if you lose your job in Europe, you know, the government swoops in there, retraining programs, there's temporary income support. If you need to move to another location to find a new job, they'll help you do that. We do very little of that for our workers in the United States. So we simply didn't help people adjust to the competition. So that's really a very legitimate complaint. I think the parts of it that are not legitimate is that a lot of this was going to happen anyway. I mean, globalization isn't just something that governments went out there and snapped their fingers and created. It's a product of the fact that you now have big container ships, so it's a lot cheaper to ship stuff across the Pacific Ocean to come to the United States. It's a result of the internet. Companies can now produce components all over the world and coordinate this for final assembly, you know, in the United States or in China or wherever. You know, I'm carrying an iPhone in my pocket. The iPhone is assembled. It's a little thing. You know what is it? It's about, you know, 2.5 inches by 5 inches. There are components from 30 different countries in this iPhone, assembled in a Taiwanese-owned contracting factory in southern China and then shipped to the United States. And the company that does that, Apple, is an American company. Creates a lot of good jobs for Americans. So a lot of this stuff would have happened anyway. The trade rules, however, have probably accelerated it. I think there's no question about that. And so people who are unhappy about trade, you don't get a vote on globalization. You don't get a vote on container shipping. You don't get a vote on the internet. You do get a vote on trade agreements and whether your politicians are going to support it or not. So I think a lot of the focus of anger over the disruption caused by globalization ends up directed at these trade agreements and at the politicians who have supported them.
Now, Trump is very against trade agreements, and he has been for decades. It's an issue that introduced him really into politics. That was one of the main issues that he picked up on when he first entered into politics. So he, right off the bat, signs an executive order effectively ending our negotiations over the TPP.
That's correct. Yeah. So I mean, trade is a foundational issue for Donald Trump. I mean, with a lot of his beliefs, it's hard to know how firmly he's committed to them, whether he adopted them for the campaign, hard to know whether he's going to stick with it. Trade, that's not the case. So the first time he flirted with the idea of running for president was in the mid-1980s, and he introduced himself to the country by taking out a full-page ad in the New York Times denouncing Japan over its large trade surplus with the United States and the fact that we were paying for their defense while they were in his term, screwing us on trade. He's believed that for a long time and ran on that very strongly in the campaign. You know, for Trump, the trade deficit is kind of a scorecard. If they're selling us more than they're buying from us, they're winning and we're losing. And the United States, for a variety of reasons, has for decades now run a very large trade deficit, particularly with China, with Germany, with Japan, and with Mexico. So those are all targets for Trump. What concerns me about Trump is I don't really think he has a strategic vision. He is really a genuine old-fashioned protectionist. You have to go back to Herbert Hoover to find the last time that the Oval Office was occupied by a president who believed that cutting the United States off from global trade would be a good thing for the country. And I think history's taught us that that's not likely to be the case. You take the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The biggest problem in global trade right now is China. And there are lots of ways in which China does not abide by the rules. It plays fast and loose with the agreements it's entered into in the World Trade Organization. And any successful trade policy that's going to do something to help American manufacturing has to focus on a tough strategic policy to get China to play by the rules. Well, so what's President Trump's first action? He walks away from a trade agreement that would have linked the United States to Japan, to Australia, to Singapore, to a dozen Pacific Rim countries under a set of rules favorable to the United States and not so favorable to China. So by walking away from that agreement, he's just given away what was potentially the biggest source of leverage that the United States had to put pressure on China. So I just worry that he doesn't have the strategic vision to carry out a trade policy that's likely to achieve the goals he wants, which I think are reasonable ones, which is to restore manufacturing to a somewhat greater share of the U.S. economy than it has currently.
You wrote an op-ed in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that kind of questioned, again, Trump's tactics. When it comes to NAFTA, what are we looking at?
Well, I think, you know, again, if you look at Trump's goals are to build more manufacturing investment, more manufacturing jobs in the United States. To be clear, that's really hard. I mean, the share of the U.S. workforce in manufacturing has been declining since the early 1970s. We used to have a quarter the American workforce in manufacturing. Today, it's less than 9%. That's a big decline. That is not all a trade story by any means. Most of that is a technology story. We use robots in the factories. We're far more productive than we've ever been before. The United States actually makes more stuff than it ever has before with a fraction of the workforce. So those are big trends that are not going to disappear. Within that, however, you can do things to encourage companies to locate and expand in the United States. And the administration is talking about things on the tax front, talking about investments in infrastructure that I think could really help with that. The NAFTA renegotiation is challenging, right? Because the way NAFTA works, it's an agreement among the United States and Canada and Mexico. And what it's supposed to do is encourage investment in North America. The idea is to have kind of seamless commerce across North America. If you look at the auto industry, I mean, cars are made of components from Canada, Mexico, assembled in different places. The auto industry is completely integrated across continental borders. So any renegotiation of NAFTA is going to have to be within that spirit. But, of course, Trump's been going after Mexico. He doesn't want companies moving to Mexico, wants to bring work back from Mexico to the United States. Not clear how you do that under NAFTA. NAFTA is about North America. You could tear it up, but then that creates a whole another set of potential problems.
It does seem like the Trump administration has been kind of bullying companies that have moved specifically to Mexico. He's, you know, threatened tariffs on Mexican products, which have concerned a lot of people. Where do those tactics end?
Yeah, I actually don't mind a little bit of bullying. And I was pleased to see Trump go after Carrier. You know, any of your listeners who saw the video of the Carrier managers announcing to the workers in the factory that their jobs were going to be moved to Mexico, it was pretty appalling. And I think Trump was right to be outraged by it. I do think, unfortunately, one of the things that's happened with American companies, and our companies are really successful. I mean, we have, you know, the lion's share of the most successful multinational companies in the world are headquartered in the United States. You started off your question about, you know, losers from globalization. Well, American companies have been big winners from globalization, and that's been good for a lot of Americans. But I think in the process, they've forgotten about their commitments and obligation to the United States. You know, being American companies gives them a lot of benefits in terms of workers who are educated here by American schools and American universities, an American government that will fight for them around the world if they run into business problems in China or Mexico or anywhere else. I think those companies owe something to the United States in return, and I think they've forgotten about that. So I didn't and don't have a problem with Trump reminding companies that they should be looking wherever they can for investment opportunities in the United States. But he's got to follow that up with something more. You've got to change the economics in some ways. You've got to make the United States a better place to invest through tax reform, through regulatory reform, through investment in infrastructure, through expansion of community colleges and other things to make sure that the skilled workers are there that the manufacturing operations need. You know, bluster and bullying alone is only going to get you so far.
Well, and that's something you mentioned in your book, a deficit in skilled workers. You know, there's this kind of dream, I think, especially strong for Wisconsinites that, you know, will return at some point to this time in which people graduate from high school, they go work at the factory, they, you know, have a nice blue-collar job. Are we going to return to that, or do we have to be looking at other solutions?
I mean, you're not, clearly, right? The nature of manufacturing work has changed substantially. A lot of it now is involved in running computers and running robots that are building things. It's much more technical and sophisticated than it was a generation ago. People who are working in those jobs need at least community college level skills. They're not going to walk straight out of high school into those jobs, and they're certainly not going to walk into them if they don't finish high school. But you know, Wisconsin has the second highest percentage of its labor force in manufacturing of any state in the United States, second only to Indiana. 16% of workers here. Those are pretty good jobs. They pay in this region on average about 30% more than other jobs. So that is still potentially a good career path for a lot of young people, but you have to set it up to allow them to be successful. We've seen, for instance, a drying up of apprenticeship programs. A lot of companies used to have apprenticeship programs. They've diminished by roughly half over the last decade. Companies are reluctant to train workers on their own. There need to be cooperative efforts between state and local governments, federal government, and companies to make sure we're training the workers that these companies are going to need. Is it going to solve Wisconsin's employment issues? No. I think over time, gradually, more and more work is going to be in the service sector in one form or another. But it's still an important part of the economy, and it is continues to be the most productive part of our economy. A lot of the growth we see comes out of the manufacturing sector.
Now, do you see these initiatives coming down from the federal government or state governments?
I would honestly like to see more of them coming out of local and state governments. I mean, one of the arguments that I make in my book is that federal trade policies should be enacted more in the service of state priorities. You know, so you have here in Wisconsin, you know, strong and successful industries in energy and power systems, in water is another area where this is a real world leader. You know, what can we do through trade policies? What can we do through export promotion at the national level to help this state and other develop its competitive advantages? And I think, I argue in my book, one of the problems with U.S. trade policy, it's been done entirely from the top down without taking input from state and local governments on what their economic development strategies are, what they're looking for in terms of developing regional economies. And so I think we need much closer cooperation that's coming more from the bottom up and much less from the top down.
So ultimately, do you feel hopeful for the Trump administration? You know, what do you think about the future?
I don't know. On Mondays and Wednesdays and Fridays, I'm hopeful. And on Tuesdays, Thursdays and Saturdays, I despair. My concern is that he does not yet have a team in place to carry out any sort of rational policy to try to achieve his ends. I'm quite supportive of his goals. I would like to see a manufacturing resurgence in the United States. I would like to see more investment in the United States. I would like to see our trade deficit lessened. I think we've run this chronic trade deficit for decades, which is not a good thing for us, not a good thing for the world. I just worry that his methods could be extremely damaging. Start slapping tariffs on imports from Mexico, which violates rules that the United States played the lead in negotiating. Other countries are going to retaliate. That's going to hurt exports from the United States. This region is extremely dependent on exports. If it wasn't for strong export growth over the last decade, Wisconsin'd still be in recession. So you know, the notion that the problem is all on the import side, well, no, the problem is also expanding exports. And you start doing stupid things like slapping arbitrary tariffs on imports, and other countries are going to retaliate, and we are going to lose from that. So I'm very worried about some of the tactics that he and his team seem to be embracing. But I'm optimistic about the goals, and I'm hoping that, you know, when Wilbur Ross is confirmed as the Commerce Secretary, when we have a U.S. trade representative, that we'll start to see a rational strategy tacked on to a reasonable set of goals.
Well, Ted, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and coming in studio.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Edward Alden is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. His specialties include U.S. economic competitiveness and trade policy. He's also author of Failure to Adjust: How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. He was recently in town for UW-Milwaukee's annual Fireside Forum series presented by the Institute of World Affairs.